Let's have a meeting. My name is Janine, and I'm an alcoholic. And happy 4th of July. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells us or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholics, men and women, in our rooms tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. So tonight's speaker, when I was first getting sober, that my sponsor told me I needed to stick with the winners. And our speaker tonight is definitely one of those winners. And, you know, definitely an excellent example of how AA works. Lisa?
My name is Lisa. I'm an alcoholic. I didn't make notes, but I have something that I want to start with, but I'm going to get the housekeeping out of the way. Can everybody hear me okay? Okay. My sobriety date is February the 16th, 2005. I have a sponsor, Lynn T., who has a sponsor. His sponsor, it goes up, and I sponsor women. My home group is everybody's meeting on Monday and Friday in Decatur at 8 o'clock, and I have a service position there, and that's really what I was told to do from the beginning, get a sponsor, work steps, and that's what I've done. And I got sober, actually, wanted to read a little bit first. I was told to have a beginning and an ending and let God fill in the rest, so... this is from, I think this is either in the Big Book or somewhere from Grapevine. I think it's in the Big Book. If we are planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol. And I just really liked that because I thought when I read that, I think I got in a daily reader that I'm really grateful that by the time I ended up in AA that I really really knew that I couldn't drink like a normal person. What it was like for me in the beginning was I come from a family full of alcoholics. My mother is an alcoholic. She has been in and out of recovery. My grandmother's an alcoholic who died of alcoholism. And so I was bound and determined not to be an alcoholic. So I really did not start drinking until a little bit later in life. But growing up in the disease of alcoholism, that, and I don't think this made me an alcoholic. I really think I was born an alcoholic and just needed to add alcohol. That's just, you know, obviously these are all my opinions, but that's how I feel about it. But all the things that come along, my mother divorced my dad when I was less than a year old. I was born in San Francisco and ended up here because of my grandparents. And we moved around very often, every 6 months to a year. My mother loved, we get along today thanks to the 12-step programs that I'm involved with, but that she laughs and says, oh, honey, I've never been attracted to boring men. And I'm like, yeah. You know, she always liked addicts and alcoholics. And, you know, I guess I can't say anything because I'm kind of the same way. But so we had, unfortunately, a lot of, from multiple people, they would either be abusive to her or us. There was sexual abuse, mental, physical abuse, emotional abuse. Not from my mom, but from the men that she selected. Not all of them were that way, but I didn't understand what alcoholism was, but I was bound and determined not to be like that. Just whatever that was, I didn't want to be that way. I've heard people say this before, and I think it's true. I would have felt better if I'd had a drink before I did, because I was just very, very on edge all the time. Things were always changing, and I felt like I had no control over it. But I didn't start drinking until I was actually in my 20s. And once I started drinking, I was like, I found my friend. I could finally relax. I was very shy. There's this, I laugh, there's a diagnosis for people who have anxiety about blushing, and that I used to blush. I could just say a word and I would blush. I was very awkward socially and didn't feel like I really fit in. I moved around a lot, so I didn't have a lot of long-term friends. And when I started drinking, you know, I could loosen up, I could talk to people, I could dance, I could have a good time. I do have to say, before I started drinking, though, I did have an eating disorder, and that's kind of been off and on. My first love of trying to control things and how I felt was food. I've been intermittently anorexic and a binge eater before there was a diagnosis for that. But once I got into 12-step recovery, I have not really had been able to be that controlling with my food anymore, so that's kind of changed. But so I was always trying, even though I thought I wasn't, you know, like my mother, I was always trying to control something to make myself feel different. But then I found alcohol, and I, during this time also in my early 20s, I went through bankruptcy and kind of struggled. I have been poor. I grew up poor. We were very poor on welfare and food stamps, and I can live poor. and I did for a long time, probably into my 30s. I was working multiple jobs and going to school, put myself through school. Didn't really have a lot of social support, none from my parents. So I started drinking, an intermittent binge drinking. So I wasn't like a daily drinker. I would periodically binge drink, and I didn't think that there was anything wrong with that. I just thought that's what people do. You go out and you have a good time, and drugs are not really a big part of my story. I haven't told this in my story before, but I did purchasing supplies for a vet hospital. I sort of purchased some things illegally, sort of legally, and reappropriated them. But I tried substitute for alcohol, but it was nice because it didn't have calories. That's terrible to say, but alcohol has a lot of calories, and if you're trying to, like, do one or the other. But, to this day, I never really put this together. When I ran out of that, I was really depressed. I never really put it together. The times in my life where I was depressed and suicidal and I was not able to drink or use like I would normally, and I actually was so depressed that I had a gun to my head, and I hated myself because I couldn't pull the trigger. And I never really put it together with the fact that I ran out of the thing that was keeping me. What I liked about alcohol and any other substance that changed how I felt was it sort of just took the edge off. Like, I felt normal, like I could breathe, like I didn't have that tense, uptight feeling that I felt like I walked around with a large percentage of the time. I'm going to school, actually ended up getting a degree and got a job finally, like a real big girl job. And I want to say during that time is when I started to develop a relationship with God. Part of my training, there was a woman that said something that I heard. And for the most part, I was an atheist. I grew up with parents who didn't raise us with religion. My dad was an atheist living back in California, but my mom was Catholic, but really never took us to church. It was a long time before I really understood what was going on because nobody ever told me anything. So it was a long time before. I can remember being really mad that nobody told me that Jesus was born on Christmas Day, I was like, what? I thought it was all about Santa and gifts. And the Easter, you know, that was really hard to figure out if you have no, you know, nobody tells you. I mean, like, what? That was so confusing to me. I thought it was all about, you know, the Easter Bunny. And so my religious, like, I just didn't wasn't brought up with it. But this woman said to me, what you're going to do is going to be hard. If you don't have a God, you better start working on, you know, getting some type of God. And I just heard that for whatever reason. And when I went into my profession that I still do now, I really took that to heart and actually started looking at different kind of religions. I think I went to a temple and took a class on Judaism and just sort of started thinking about it. But I was still drinking intermittently. It hadn't caused me any problems at this point. And I thought, you know, even though when I started drinking, I knew enough. I got educated about what alcoholism was, and so I understood. And I was not a daily drinker. I hadn't lost jobs. I mean, after all, I mean, it did take me 10 years to get my degree, but that's because it was expensive. And I was just like, I was just crazy. I had, I don't know, I struggled with asking for help, and I just thought I had to do everything on my own. I think life got better for me when I wasn't totally broke all the time. But I was still not an alcoholic. I did not call them blackouts. I called them gray outs because I only lost short periods of time. It wasn't like an actual day-long thing. Now I look back. I mean, of course, I never really acknowledged them at the time. But I also, unfortunately, drank and drove, even though I knew better. But whenever I closed down the bar and I would start drinking water and coffee because, you know, that sobers you up, you know. But I always wanted to just drive home. I didn't want to take a taxi. I just wanted to be in my own car. I do remember one time, and I don't usually share much about my drunkalogs, but I was, this reminded me of it. I was downtown and I saw the masquerade. I did a lot of drinking at the masquerade. And I was there with my boyfriend, who was more drunk than me, and so I drove because I'm a very good driver. And I was driving down Ponce, and I think I was in a blackout. And I came to, and there was like blue lights in the mirror. And there's a bullhorn, and I couldn't understand him. And I was like, my boyfriend was no help at all. I don't know if he's passed out. I don't really remember him being that helpful, but. I didn't pull over because I couldn't understand him. I thought, well, I'm not going to pull over. I can't understand him. And I just kept driving. I probably was driving really slow, and then he disappeared. And I should have gotten pulled over and gotten a DUI, but for whatever reason, I didn't. And I've never been in trouble with the law, but I should have been because I got into trouble. I drank and drove and you know, did things that weren't necessarily on the up and up, let's see, so periodic binge drinking, I never really tried to control my drinking. I know when I first started reading in the Big Book about, and this is in Al-Anon, I was a Big Book Al-Anon, my mom got 12-stepped into AA by a coworker of mine. By this time I'm kind of working, making more money, doing a little more periodic binge drinking. What I noticed over my drinking career is that the drinking got closer and closer together. I would do it when I didn't mean to. You know, all the things you read about, I made a solemn oath that I wasn't going to do this at this time. It was a bad time to do it. And like, that's the one thing that I'm grateful for is I know I have no defense against first drink. And, you know, thankfully I was relieved of that when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I want to get sober on time. So I don't want to keep people late. Periodic binge drinking, my mom got sober about, I had, she hit her bottom, and it was mostly on pills. My mom was got sober through AA, but was mostly a prescription pill addict. She hit her bottom on multiple psychiatric drugs, and because she found a writer, somebody who would dole out. My mom's intelligent, and she would call me and say, "Honey, I have a new diagnosis and a new medication to go with it." And I was like, "Oh my God, that was, you know." And that, her bottom was my bottom and my Al-Anon bottom. Because I always felt responsible for her, but I still, like, I'm not like she was. I mean, she's really crazy. You know, I just blow off steam every once in a while. I mean, that's normal, right? So the guy who 12-stepped her into AA actually tried to 12-step me into AA because he'd seen me drinking, but I was like, he does not understand. And it was funny because I'd never remember hearing about Al-Anon, but obviously somebody planted the seed in my head because I thought, well, I'm not going to go to AA, but I need Al-Anon because clearly my mother is the problem. But it took me about a year because I didn't want to do it. I just didn't want to. I've been in therapy. I've done a lot of therapy on my childhood things that happened to me, group therapy and not a ton because it's expensive, but I just didn't want to. So about a year into her recovery, I hit my Al-Anon bottom and couldn't stand it anymore, and went to an Al-Anon meeting and got a sponsor and actually started working the steps. And on my first night, I met her, and she was Big Book Al-Anon. So as an Al-Anon, I went through the Big Book, but I didn't relate to it because I wasn't an alcoholic. I didn't drink like Bill Wilson. Like, I found the reasons for myself not to be an alcoholic, not to belong. And so I kind of kept up this periodic binge drinking, but as I said, the times that went between the drinking got closer and closer, and when I think about step one, at the end, I definitely knew I was powerless over alcohol, but unmanageability for me looked a little bit different because I hadn't lost jobs. I was still working. I actually was in the military. I got into the military because in my early 40s, because that seemed like a good idea. I'm not that good in the military, but it was fun. I mean, I did a lot of cool stuff, and but the drinking definitely accelerated. It's a great place to find out if you're an alcoholic because it's very condoned as part of the culture. And I can remember doing training things, and they were like, everybody was drinking. And I would be like, no, this is bad. I don't need to be drinking now. And I would end up drinking. You know, I was the person who would go around and drink everybody's glasses if they left it there too long because, you know, I just drank. And that's the one thing that at the end, though, I did try controlled drinking. I talked to a woman who is now my sponsor that I've known and who saw me drinking before I even got into Al-Anon. I knew her from work, and I would be like, "Well, you see me drink. I'm not really an alcoholic because I really didn't want to. I loved alcohol. I did not want to stop drinking, and that's why it took me so long to really kind of acknowledge that I was powerless over alcohol because I felt like I could handle it. I just drank. I drank when it was around. I drank if somebody passed me a drink. I never knew. Sometimes I could control it. Not real often. I was usually aware of how much I was drinking if I was controlling it, but I never tried that often to stop, and I never tried to not drink. Usually somebody passed me a drink. So at the end, though, I did try what's suggested in the Big Book, which is, well, I've tried a couple things. Once I tried to stop, stay away for a year, and that didn't really work that well. I went a long time, but then I forgot. And drank again. And then this time, though, I tried the daily drinking, drinking just a little bit because, I mean, I didn't have a problem. I can control it. And that's the first time that I really started to really kicked in my obsession. And then I really understood. And what it feels like to be, like, wake up in the morning. I mean, I wasn't a morning drinker because that means you're an alcoholic. But towards the end, I really wanted to drink in the morning, and I thought, oh, God, this is not good. But I still tried to control it for a little while, but I, my sponsor told me to do something which I think helped in my hitting my bottom, which was I prayed. I had, when I got into Al-Anon, I did develop a relationship with a higher power, God of my understanding, and so I was praying. I said the third and seventh step prayer, and I think the way that that helped me was because I had a shorter period of time where I was drinking daily, you know, a head full of AA and a belly full of alcohol. It just was a really painful place to be in. I was away from home. I didn't have any of my friends around. I had a pretty good support network here. And when I hit my bottom, I was alone. I didn't like what I was doing, really. And I just was getting nothing from God, and I wasn't sure what to do. And I called AA. I called the hotline. And I'm grateful that it went down that way. I had to pick up the phone. I didn't really have, you know, my support network. I couldn't lean on and say, hey, can I go to a meeting with you? And so I went, I think it was the next night. I didn't even have a meeting close to me that night because it was a pretty small town where I got sober. And I knew that I couldn't, that I was powerless over the first drink, and that I was powerless over alcohol. And my life was unmanageable in weird sort of ways, but I was going to say, when I introduced myself, my name is Lisa, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a real alcoholic, that kind of says in the big book, and the reason I was going to say it that way is because when I got sober, there was this guy who introduced himself that way, and I was really, like, he said when he told the story, some of you in here tonight are not real alcoholics like me. And, you know, he even alluded to the fact that people who come in the back way, like through Al-Anon, weren't really alcoholics. And I was just very offended by that. But actually, in retrospect, I'm grateful for that experience, because what it caused me to do was to, like, really earn my seat. I started going, what does he mean by that? I deserve to be here just as much as anybody else. There's tradition 3 or 5, the one that says the only requirement 3. That's right, the tradition is. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I read through the big book because I wasn't real happy to be an alcoholic. I was really pissed off about it, to be honest with you. I was mad, and I wasn't happy. I actually did, though, get a sponsor on my first night. It was a women's meeting. And I picked her mostly because I just thought I was going to go into the meeting and get a white chip and just sit in the back. But that did not happen. They don't have white chips in Illinois. They have stars and cards. So I have a white card that I got at 30 days, and I went back and got a card at a year, and they actually put little stars for every year you've been sober after that. So I was pissed off because I couldn't get a white chip, and because I called my sponsor and I said, what am I supposed to do? I mean, this is ridiculous. What am I supposed to do? This is my sobriety date or something stupid like that. I mean, I don't know. I was just mad. So actually, people talked directly to me in the meeting. I had a woman get up and sit down beside me and hold my hand during the meeting and talk, like, to my face. I was so mortified. And then this woman came up to me after the meeting and said, oh, my God, that was terrible. And I said, yes, it was. Will you be my sponsor? And I started working the steps out of the big book in a different way than I had before. And, you know, I'm really grateful for that woman. I actually got in touch with her recently. She, at the time, she had a couple years sober. She got a couple of DUIs, and she had a breathalyzer in a car. Occasionally we'd go places and she'd have to pull over and use the breathalyzer. But yeah, I started working the steps. I have had the opportunity of moving multiple times in sobriety. And I've always been the kind of person that said, I'm not going to be that person who has a hard time when I move. I'm flexible. I'm easygoing. You know, I'm not all uptight. And every single time I've moved, I've had a hard time fitting back into sobriety wherever I've gone. And eventually it grows on me, but I just... every single time. But so when I moved back into Atlanta, I actually had a hard time. I got a sponsor, the woman that I was talking to before I left, started working the steps again. And I had a harder time plugging back into Atlanta. I don't know why, just because it was different. I had gone to, in Illinois, the meetings were an hour and a half. You had a break about an hour. I did my 90-90. I was going to say, I don't know, where I got sober was a clubhouse where you had to introduce yourself and say you're an alcoholic, and I was, every single time, because it was close to where I was living temporarily. And by day 31, I was so excited to say, not have to raise my hand and say I was an alcoholic. But that, I think, was good for me as well, just to kind of, part of that earning my seat. When I was reading through the big book, I was looking for what a bottom was. And I've yet to find that. It's not in there. I mean, they talk about their drinking experiences, and what was really important for me in the beginning was to listen to the similarities, not the differences. And that really helped, because I think that's what I was doing when I was in Al-Anon. I would hear anybody, and I would just look for all the differences, the reasons that I wasn't an alcoholic. And, you know, I've been through the book a lot with new sponsees, working steps, and the more I read it, I continue to see more and more how I can relate, and how I drank the same way, just not to the extent that they did. So I'm grateful for that suggestion. So I came back to Atlanta, eventually got a home group, was working through the steps with my sponsor, and then a couple years sober, I learned how to skydive, because that's fun. I went hang gliding, I got tattooed, and I had a job here, but still I was bored, so I decided to go back to school again, 45 to get another degree. And during a couple years before that, my dad, might have been an alcoholic. He described himself as an alcoholic. I kind of learned to stop figuring that out, because it really didn't matter. Thanks to the program of Al-Anon, I developed a relationship again with my dad and my mom. That really deepened, and we got along, you know, much better. I stopped hating them for the things that happened to me in my childhood. But my dad was diagnosed with lung cancer, I think about the time I got sober. He had surgery, and he was cancer free for a while. But so I am just kind of sharing this as an 11th step sort of experience for me. You know, I'd gone through all the steps, and I was praying daily. I prayed daily for a long time, the third and seventh step. I do, like I said, I sponsor women. One of my longest time sponsees is just got 8 years. And I continue to sponsor women and take them through the steps. But I continually work on my relationship with my higher power today, or God. That was one of the things that I fought when I first came in, because I thought I wasn't raised with religion, but I had a chip on my shoulder about religion. I was convinced that somebody was going to jump out and ask me to believe that Jesus Christ is my personal savior. I just knew it. or somebody who's going to ask me to believe a certain way or a certain thing. And I mean, we do say the Lord's Prayer and things like that, you know, so it gets someone to believe that, they, you know, there's going to be a certain way that you're going to have to believe eventually, but that has never happened. And, you know, that's one of the wonderful things is that we get to have our own concept of God. Mine is kind of big. I have a big God today, and I'm grateful for that. For a long time, I kind of wanted to put my God in a box, and I'm saying God mostly because it's short and easy to say, but, you know, I wanted to be able to understand it because I thought it would make it easier to turn my life over to something that I understood. But now it didn't really help, and it just made me confused. The more I found the times that I have more peace in my life, and it was when I'm not struggling, is when I'm just kind of going, you know what, I don't get it. I don't understand. I can't label it. I can't make it a certain thing. But I have much more peace when I'm not struggling, fighting, going, well, people say this or that, and I don't understand why you're saying this or that. And that's one of the things that was really good with my sponsors. When I would call her and say, so-and-so said this in a meeting, what does that mean? She would go, you know, you don't have to believe what they're saying. And that's one thing, you know, it's all just our opinions. When we talk in a meeting, it's all our own experience, strength, and hope, and you can take what you like and leave the rest. And certainly that's true tonight, and that's what I do when I go to meetings. It helps me struggle less, is just to remember that we're all just doing the best that we can. I had this idea. I always go back and visit my family, and in San Francisco, which is not the worst place in the world to visit, but I decided that I was not going to do that this time. I was in a break at school, and I was working. Part of my unmanageability can be working too much, which is when I know that my life's getting unmanageable. So I was working a bunch and going to school, and my dad was cancer-free, and I decided I was going to take a car trip and go up the East Coast and hang out with friends and just do some stuff like that. But I kept getting this, like, nagging feeling that I should go home, that I needed to go home. And I fought with that inner voice, you know. I just had to struggle with that. And finally, I talked to my sponsor. I mean, I did the whole thing, like, angst over this thing. And finally, I decided to just go see my dad, not do what I wanted to do. Even though I thought, well, his last scan was good, he's fine. So I got off this was in August, I got off the airplane, and I got in the car, and he closed the door, and he said, well, my cancer's back, and it's in my brain, and it's probably in my liver. And my dad was very, it's like if you think of an English gentleman, extremely stoic. Just never displayed a lot of emotion, was not very, he got more loving towards the end, but my grandmother was not very loving. She's passed away recently, it's mean to say. She lived to be 94 because she was mean as a snake. She was mean. Luckily I had my one grandmother, the alcoholic. She was sweet. I mean, I loved her. So my dad told me that, and what I didn't know at the time was it was the last time I was able to be with him when he was able to walk, because he became paralyzed from bone cancer about 2 months later. And if I hadn't gone, if I hadn't listened to my gut and gone, I would have missed out on that opportunity. We always kind of did the same things. I always felt like the kid when I went out there. We would always go to these certain places. We would eat at certain restaurants. And, you know, when he was sick, that's one of the things that hit me. I didn't want it to change. I wanted to stay that way forever. So I was in school, working, and flying back and forth to California, which I'm grateful that I could afford to do that. And a little bit crazy. Just a little, but I had the opportunity to talk with him about what it was going to be like. I did ask him if he wanted me to be there when he died, and he said, I shouldn't laugh, but he said, no, you've seen people die before, right? And I'm like, Yeah, and I told my story once, and I realized I didn't say I'm in healthcare. I was like, people probably think I'm really weird. I work in a hospital, so that was his response. You know, stiff upper lip. I'm not going to get sad or anything. So I was honestly, I was kind of relieved because it was hard. It's harder, much harder when it's your family member, but. So I was supposed to go out there on Thanksgiving Day, and I did. I flew out on Thanksgiving Day, and he waited. I didn't think he would, but he did. He was in and out of this kind of coma until I got there, and when I landed, he passed away within about 2 or 3 hours of me being there. And I think a lot of that, I was more there for my stepmom because I was the only one who could stay with him. It was me and her, and some stranger came in and kept talking while he was dying. It was weird. It was a weird experience. And I guess it was good in a way because it distracted her while he was dying. I don't know. It was odd. But so, you know, I'm grateful that I was able to show up. I, in emotional situations, I can be a runner. When my grandfather passed away, my grandmother, I wasn't around at all when my grandmother passed away. When my grandfather passed away, I was there more at the end. But one of the last things that he said to me, he died suddenly, unexpectedly, and when he was 80, in his 80s, but... he was in the hospital, and I had gone to see him, and they were coming in to bathe him, and I had to do something. You know, I'm always off doing something, and the last thing he said to me was, he goes, "Oh, there goes Lisa. She's always in a hurry." That stinks when that's the last thing that somebody said to you. I told him I loved him, but, you know, that was the last words out of his mouth, and so I was running out the door. And I was able to be there for... my dad in a way that I wasn't able to be there for other people, but and thanks, you know, to AA and Al-Anon, I am able to have a relationship again with my mother. There have been years that I haven't talked to her at all, and you know, now I go shopping with her. She's so crazy as ever. I say she's kind of in and out. She doesn't drink, but occasionally she smokes marijuana. My mother's 71, you know, and I just have stopped trying to control what she does. I'm like, really, Mom, with your memory problems, you probably don't need to be doing that. But she goes, "Oh, honey, I can't get my hands on it that much." I'm like, okay, Mom. She's funny. But, you know, the good thing is I can laugh about it because for a long time I really hated her. For kind of not keeping us safe when we were growing up, and I had a lot of resentments, but I still felt responsible for taking care of her, so that's my other disease. So today, I have a home group. I have worked the steps. I just recently did a fourth and fifth step. I am actually temporarily relocating in the near future. I always laugh. I have lived in Athens, is one of the other places that I've lived. After I got my education, I did go up to Athens and worked up there for a year and got to experience sobriety in Athens, and I loved it. I had a home group, and it was a really good group of people. I actually fell in love with the Wii version of the Serenity Prayer because that's what they all said. And, you know, every place that I've gone, people love me into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm really grateful for that. But I'm temporarily relocating in September to the Antarctica for 6 months. And they have, for one of the first things that I did was I started looking for meetings. They have one in a tiny church that's there because, you know, AA is everywhere. It's even on the bottom of the earth. And that's the cool thing. Like, I'm going to have, my people are going to be there. You know, that's the one thing I never found. I never belonged. I never belonged anywhere. And I never felt like I fit in anywhere because I moved around a lot. And, you know, and here I found my people. And I feel a part of, and I feel like I've been able to live my life in a way that is much fuller because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, I'm very grateful. And I am going to close with a reading from The Language of the Heart by Bill Wilson, some of his writings from the grapevine, but this is something that I really liked. From the beginning, communication in AA has been unusual and sometimes unique. Because of our kinship and suffering, and because our common means of deliverance are effective for ourselves only when constantly carried to others, our channels of contact have always been charged with the language of the heart. And that's it.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Antarctica will be lucky to have you. They might think it's the top of the year. thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speaker Meeting tonight.
Follow.